This is the BBC Third Programme. We present a programme about Wilhelm Furtwängler, compiled by Christopher Newton for the 10th anniversary of the conductor's death.
Only once did I see him conduct, and that was in Rome when I was a student, and I was able to sit behind the orchestra so that one saw Furtwängler in action. And I must say, I'd never been so impressed by anybody else with this terrific authority and power he had. It seemed to me that he had the full personality, the conviction, the ability to make people do things all of one way. When those eyes opened, my goodness, something happened. The work in question was the Brahms Third Symphony. The symphony starts with two bars, woodwind chords, and then in the third bar, the full orchestra comes in. Well, I have never, ever heard that third bar played as it was. You had the chord you really dreamed of, the impact, it was shattering.
Meredith Davies' recollection of the first time he heard Wilhelm Furtwängler is typical of the musician's view of him. For in one sense, Furtwängler was a musician's musician. Not that he was esoteric or incomprehensible to his audience. On the contrary, his effect on audiences has become a legend. But that effect was achieved with such artistry that the sheer skill behind the magic was seldom apparent except to his colleagues. He was a musician's musician in that sense only. Furtwängler addressed himself to the world and stated his belief that without a community to whom it was addressed, artistic form has no meaning at all. But it's not surprising that the most revealing tributes come from his colleagues. Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau writes, "His ever more enraptured realization of wide-ranging worlds of sound appeared different in kind and stemming from a deeper genius than in the work of any other conductor I know. His concerts were for me an emotional experience which I have never known since." The effect on orchestral musicians is here recalled by Gregor Piatigorsky and Leon Goossens.
He addressed them like equal artists. He demanded from them as much as he would demand from himself. But his great sincerity, in other words, he lifted them up, very often making them bigger than they really were. That was his ability, his personal magnetism, because of the, such a richness, a fantastic, creative, truly creative, not only recreative, ability. And I find quite unique that human element of spontaneity was always there.
He had that youngness of outlook. Every time he conducted a work, you felt that it was another work, or it was the first time he was doing it, you know. It gave a freshness to it. It's something you want to give a man. If you click like that with him and you know exactly what he wants and you're going to help him the whole way, you just give it to him like that.
In a BBC talk, Furtwängler himself said this of the conductor's task.
However high the technical capacity of an orchestra may be, the conductor has one arch enemy to fight: routine. Routine is something very human, very understandable. It's a line of least resistance, and there's no denying that in daily life it has its advantages. But all the more must we insist that it plays the most deadly role in music, especially in the performance of old and familiar works. In fact, routine, with its loveless mediocrity and its treacherous perfection, lies like hoar frost on the performance of the most beautiful and best-known works.
Neither his rehearsals nor his performances were ever routine. Here is Fritz Peppermüller of the Berlin Philharmonic.
1921, Furtwängler was expected in Hanover to conduct a symphony concert. On the program was the Eighth of Bruckner. And the first rehearsal was very interesting for me. The impression was fascinating for a German musician. And so he did the Bruckner and all the people that we never heard such a concert. And my teacher in this time was the leader of the orchestra in Hanover. And the next day I had a lesson. And my professor said, yeah, it was a wonderful concert, wonderful concert. But he will pick out the soul of you, and therefore only twice a month a concert. Otherwise it will be too hard work for us.
It was with performances of the Bruckner symphonies that Furtwängler had his early successes, beginning with a concert in Munich at the age of 20, in which he added his own symphonic study in B minor to a performance of Bruckner's Ninth.
Education was from another world, so to speak. His father was a very famous archaeologist, and his father took him from school when he was 13 or 14 years old, because he was not a good pupil, and so he got private lessons. And his mother was a friend of Clara Schumann, the famous pianist and wife of Robert Schumann, and his father took him to Egypt and took him to Firenze when he was 17 years old, and that was his education. And he was a composer first. Later on, when he became 18 or 19 years, his father died, and he had to do something to earn money, of course. And so he became conductor and went first to Zurich, later to Strasbourg. In Strasbourg was Pfitzner director in this time, and Klemper, and he were co-repetite. And in Zurich, he told me once, I had to conduct the operetta, the Merry Widow, and I had to conduct the ballet, and the ballet had to leave the stage, and I was much more in the moment interested in the legs of the ballet, and I forgot that the tenor had to sing now. And the tenor said, well, if you don't like to give me my cue, then I sing alone. And so he did, and I had very quick to follow with my baton, no? And the intendant would fire me, but he did need me, because I was in this time a very good piano player, and in this time came out the operas of Richard Strauss. And to play the scores were very difficult, but I was a very good piano player, and so the intendant didn't fire me because he did need me for the Strauss operas.
Although his technical skill as a pianist was acknowledged, his style was very much the subject of controversy. Hiera Piatigorsky, Berthold Goldschmidt, Hans Keller and the pianist Daniel Barenboim.
I loved to play chamber music with him. I loved his piano playing. I thought he was one of the finest chamber music performer on the piano. And there was something of a child in him, a great, great naivety. And the orchestra just adored him.
The whole procedure during rehearsals as well as during the actual performance had the character of a spiritual seance. And Furtwängler quite often mesmerized his players as well as his audiences into accepting interpretations which were not entirely defensible stylistically. Mozart, for instance, is a case in point, and I remember particularly Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 5, where he played the long solo for the harpsichord himself on a Steinway grand and in a manner that suggested Brahms rather than Johann Sebastian Bach. When it was over, one very often realized that what one had heard was marvelous but wrong.
In all those dimensions, he was by far the greatest conductor I'd ever come across. There's no question about it. And his Bach performances, which, of course, were in no way what one nowadays calls authentic, were the greatest I ever heard.
His conception of Bach was rather personal, and I mean it in the positive sense. It was not what you would call a pure performance, but then what is pure in music? It was a performance that brought Bach's masterpiece completely alive. It was a line that went from the first note to the very last and captured everybody.
did not like Furtwängler's Bach, though he acknowledged the tremendous success that Furtwängler scored with the Brandenburg Concerto. At the next rehearsal, Furtwängler remarked, "Too many people think if they are not bored by the music of Bach, it has not been played in the right style."
That was Simon Goldberg, who was for many years leader of the Berlin Philharmonic. Furtwängler enjoyed playing the piano enormously. Here is an occasion recalled by Elisabeth Schwarzkopf.
After the war, I asked the Salzburg Festival whether they shouldn't really do some Lieder recitals in their programs. And in one of those years, I was supposed to do a Hugo Wolf recital. And I remember we were doing the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven in Turin with Furtwängler. And after the performance, we sat together. And Furtwängler said, half jokingly, I thought, "Well, I hear you are doing a recital, Lieder recital in Salzburg again this year. What is it?" I said, "It's all Hugo Wolf." "Ah, isn't that interesting? Well, have you already got an accompanist?" "No, not yet." "Well, would you consider me? Do you think I would do for that?" Of course, I was flabbergasted, really. I didn't think that was meant seriously, but it was. And then this man, whom we are all were in great awe of, whenever you passed his little hotel where he stayed, it was a little castle outside of Salzburg, you could hear him practice for hours, scales up and down and across the piano. And then, of course, he didn't practice only for himself, but we had long rehearsals for that recital. And I think it made a very great impression. He accompanied, of course, very wonderfully, but he did impose his tempi. Oh, yes. I remember in the Figaro or Don Giovanni arias, which I had to do very often with him in the performances in Salzburg. But I must say that with Furtwängler, those very slow tempi were always comfortable, and when he carried you on a cushion all the time. Whereas I remember when Furtwängler then fell ill, where the slow arias were really, with him, very, very comfortable, and then another conductor, of course, had to take over, and he tried to do the same tempi, and it was impossible. It was only him who could really sustain those tempi. There was never any moment where you were not convinced that he was right. I think his most striking quality was this tremendous conviction which he brought to everything, and you couldn't think of that any other way would have been the right way. You thought this was the last word on everything he did, and you were able to do with him.
Thank you.
Furtwängler's ability to convince his artists did not always extend to the critics. His Don Giovanni in Salzburg, at which that recording was made, was fiercely attacked for being stylistically more like Beethoven or Furtwängler than Mozart, and above all for being too slow. Here is what Simon Goldberg has to say of Furtwängler's supposed subjectivity.
Furtwängler was considered to be the so-called romantic or subjective conductor, the musician that freely, or too freely, interpreted the score. Furtwängler, in my opinion, read the text as conscientiously as any so-called true-to-the-score musician. You may agree or disagree with his tempi or his frequent changes of tempi, but Furtwängler did not leave tempi and the relation between the tempi to chance. He knew exactly what he did. His way of music making created the impression as if he would permanently improvise, but it really was not so. He conducted according a very definite plan, and what was generally supposed to be improvisation was just imaginative planning. And whenever we rehearsed, and when we were on a tour, for instance, and gave 30 concerts in 30 days, not only did we rehearse every day, but you could observe Furtwängler sitting or even standing in his compartment and conducting for hours. But of course, you can afford to improvise if you are on firm basis. Furtwängler was certainly on a very firm basis, planning ahead or outlining ahead the whole work.
In his book concerning music, Furtwängler says, the rehearsal must fulfill its function as a preparation. That is to say, there should be no more improvisation in the performance than is absolutely necessary. But there should not be less either, a point which deserves special emphasis. This remark provided further ammunition for attacks on his subjectivity. Here are the reactions of Gareth Morris, Daniel Barenboim, and Eugen Jochum.
Of course, Furtwängler was so much bigger than any of his critics, and his heart was so much larger, that I'm afraid I can't be bothered with any of those minor criticisms. What he did with the music was so wonderful and so full of conviction and beauty that it just didn't matter if he varied the tempo, and I'm utterly convinced that the composers would have been overjoyed to hear their music like that, with an audience lost in rapture. And in my personal experience, the orchestra too. He did vary the tempos, but does it specifically ever say in any great symphony, do not vary the tempo in the recapitulation?
Actually, he can make a recapitulation sound like a real homecoming because they have been all these little fluctuations of tempo, which have to be, of course, almost unnoticeable, that when the recapitulation sounds back, you immediately catch your chair and you say, ah, you know, here we are, this is the real homecoming. The effect is absolutely overwhelming because you really get the inner feeling of the recapitulation and not just the formal musical meaning of it. The same goes for a development.
And when he modified the tempo, he modified it so wonderful that the music hearer didn't feel that it is a modification of a tempo. It was so fluently, like a line of a human body.
Here are Furtwängler's own views on his tempi, followed by those of Yehudi Menuhin.
There's no such thing as standardized tempi. Each tempo stands in a necessary relation to the possibilities of the volume of sound. In a small hall with good acoustics, the tempi can be broader than in an excessively big hall with bad acoustics, in which the instruments can't develop all their warmth and power. I have been trying for years to set down in words my views on the rendering of music, but there isn't time for that now. The long and the short of it is that an interpreter can render only what he has first lived through. A formula for the correct rendering of everything, which can become a universal law applicable to every case? No, there isn't such a thing. So many people assume there is. A good deal will always depend on the acoustics of the hall, the individuality of the conductor, the chance of the hour.
He wasn't at all constricted or in any way under the shadow of the metronome, and he couldn't bear any kind of interpretation or any kind of conducting that felt subject to the mechanical beat. Well, he once tried to justify and explain it to me. He said, people make fun of my beat. They say that it is difficult and confusing. It may be so, he said, but it has one great advantage, and that is that it keeps everybody sitting on the edge of their chair and reacting, as it were, with the sixth sense, instinctively, intuitively, and as a unit. And he was able to encompass an enormous space in his interpretations because he never felt driven. He never felt forced to pack everything tightly into a given number of beats. Sometimes he would be able to take a slow movement more slowly than any other person, and yet it never left one without the feeling of the pulse. It never fell apart. It never disintegrated, because behind it all was the vision of the whole.
Spontaneity and immediacy of Furtwängler's performances cannot by their nature be properly preserved in recordings. The influence extends beyond those who are actually present at performances. Vladimir Ashkenazy trained in Russia and never heard Furtwängler in the concert hall.
When I first heard his Beethoven recordings, before I heard this conductor, that conductor, all very famous and all very great. But when I heard his recordings of Beethoven, I thought, that's it. That's how it should be played, you know. But I never forget the moments when I heard it first, really. His Beethoven, it never sounds rough. It sounds with tremendous willpower, but never rough. It's very weighty. At the same time, it's never heavy. I don't know really how he could reach such results.
And Furtwängler always told me, Jochum, I don't like to have an accord. I like to have an accord. Wham. And therefore I do. Wham. But sometimes it was very difficult for the orchestra.
Also another thing strikes me, the texture of the orchestra, especially in his fortissimo. Again, they're never rough. And in his fortissimo, you always feel every voice of the orchestra. I mean the texture. It's quite unique. I never hear any fortissimo in any other orchestra so beautiful. The most important for me is that he takes works, any work as a whole, and he looks at it as from a very high point. And I always feel at the end of this work that, there was that beginning and there was that middle, there was that development, and it couldn't be otherwise. It could be only like this. And if you especially don't notice change of the tempi, you never notice it. But if you look for it, you notice it tremendously. And that's one of the secrets of real rubato, which shouldn't be noticeable because it should be logical. And that's how Furtwängler does it. And if speaking about Tchaikovsky performances, it's very, very emotional, but not over-emotional, no, not just showy emotional. Furtwängler's performances of Tchaikovsky are wonderful. to the 4th and 6th symphony, I almost can't imagine played any better.
His rather critical colleagues, who otherwise would not say very kind things about him, were all floored by his recording of the Tchaikovsky Pathétique. And I remember Toscanini played it to us one night in Riverdale in New York, and was full of admiration for this recording. He felt it was one of the finest that was ever made.
Friedelind Wagner, a granddaughter of the composer and the only member of the Wagner family to leave Germany on principle during the Nazi regime. She knew both Furtwängler and Toscanini, and ironically it was the differences between these two men that provided the focal point for the controversies, both musical and political, which surrounded Furtwängler.
It may seem rather strange to you that even 10 years after Furtwängler's death, there is no one opinion about him. He still is a highly controversial person. And if you ask people all over the world about him as an artist and as a person, you will probably only get contradictory opinions. And this is always the sad thing about great men, because they're always surrounded by sycophants, people who just blindly worship and fawn upon them. Or you get detractors who are so blinded by hatred and resentments that there again you cannot get the true picture. And I think maybe one day people will also be more just about Furtwängler's political role as time goes by, as our eyes are not as bloodshot by hatred and prejudice.
The musical controversy gave rise to myths about both Furtwängler and Toscanini. Gregor Piatigorsky, who played for them both, has this to say.
He would do purposely certain things, like the chorale and the end of the First Symphony by Brahms. He would play it certainly much broader, although there is no indication in the score. So that was the contrary of Maestro Toscanini, who did not believe in doing anything what is not in the score. So now this again exaggerated, exaggerated the majority of the people who would say that Maestro Toscanini was so tremendously exact, exactly as it is in the score. It was almost like a metronome. It's not true at all, because Toscanini, being a huge artist he was also tremendously free. And I played with him, and I know that it was not at all. It is just a kind of a stamp some artists would get. You see, that one is kind of a great improviser, and the other is more matter of fact, etc. No, I think actually everything is relative, and only the truly great performer knows it. I think no one knew it more than Furtwängler.
The other half of that particular myth is that Toscanini took everything fast and Furtwängler took everything slow. But as Piatigorsky said, being the huge artists they were, their tempi were really related to what they saw in a piece. Listen to their recordings of the opening of Mozart's G minor symphony, Toscanini's first.
This is jolly fast and jolly dramatic, that first movement of the G minor symphony. But those who say that this is absolutely unprecedented, of course, haven't really reacted to his performances before, don't know enough about them. What he needed, basically, as an interpreter, was enough space to phrase and drama. Well, enough space to phrase tends towards slowness and drama tends towards quickness.
To me, the only purity in the music is if you can bring the composer's message through. And I personally have never felt the message of the G minor symphony or of Don Giovanni, for that matter, any clearer than from the Furtwängler performances. It just had all the tension and all the tragic implications of the work. But there, this tragic anxiety can really only be brought out in this tempo, and it's actually marked allegro molto. But if you look in music for a sort of pleasant pastime, then you should never hear a Furtwängler performance.
This is perhaps the key to the controversy, his profound conviction that the tragic element, as manifested in the conflict of forces and ideas, was the really constructive element in all great music. That, coupled with an uncomfortable and almost limitless subjectivity in his personal life from an early age, which was probably accentuated by his private education. Here is his wife, Elisabeth Furtwängler, followed by some others who knew him.
When he was very young, he said once, "If I have no reason to be happy, I'm unhappy." And I think that is characterizing for his whole life. Because if he was conducting, or if he was going on the mountains, or if he was in love with somebody, then he was happy. But he was very depressed about our life, and of course, he had no patience. When he wished something, it must be there at once. The car, or when he was conducting, they must see it now, and this way.
I don't think he was really interested in the daily life, and so if he had to occupy himself with ordinary things, he was very, naturally, very impatient. I always remember his power of concentration as something quite extraordinary. The way he could switch out from ordinary daily life to his own life. He would, for instance, sit at a meal half an hour still before his concert, and if my father went and said, "Mr. Furtwängler, you must come now, the car is outside," he would say, "Oh, Strebi, just wait a moment, I would like to have a little sleep." And sitting on his chair, he would have a little sleep for 5 minutes. And when he woke up, he was completely in a different world. You could still speak to him and he'd answer your questions, but it was somehow far away. And as a child, I was most impressed. He used to come to our house and sit outside in the garden and conduct for an hour or 2 hours without even a score. And we could walk past or speak and he wouldn't take any notice. He just sat there and worked. And that was another thing. He used to work when he walked. He went a lot for walks.
He had a close affinity to nature, to wood and sea and mountains. He couldn't live without living in nature. When he was on tour, he did everything to have the possibility for walking, but not lazy, intense, running like a young man.
He was not interesting whether I could follow or not. He walked. One always say Furtwängler was romantic. He was not romantic in this way. He had a very good sense of reality, always.
Despite his seriousness, he was not without humor. A young English girl, finding herself next to him at a dinner in Salzburg and determined not to be intimidated, asked him, "Who is better, maestro, you or Toscanini? My friends say Toscanini, but I always say you're just as good." The air froze for minutes until the silence was broken by howls of laughter from Furtwängler. Yehudi Menuhin.
He was a very sensual man and loved the ladies and was always genial, was always approachable. Despite his very aristocratic and rather commanding aspect, he was in fact very naive and very simple and enjoyed the pleasant things.
Of course, one thing one must say, he detests cocktails or something. He was suffering if he thought he would be invited of somebody. He was not fond to meet any princess. He doesn't care at all. But he was very fond to see or to speak with real people of art who really know something. He was always interested in worthwhile things.
But there was one glittering social occasion that was his by right. As conductor of the state opera and the orchestra in Vienna, the annual ball of the Vienna Philharmonic, at which he conducted himself. Vienna and Berlin became his home ground. From the opera house at Mannheim, where he had become director at the age of 29, he went on to succeed Richard Strauss at the Berlin Opera House, and when Arthur Nikisch died in 1922, he took over the Berlin Philharmonic and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestras, the two most important musical posts in Germany. He succeeded Felix Weingartner in Vienna in 1927. Although before the war, Furtwängler had conducted in New York, Paris, and London, it was not generally thought, in his later years, his increasingly personal style would be properly understood by any but his own orchestras. However, he conducted the Philharmonia after the war and made his highly successful recording of Tristan with them. This is how Gareth Morris remembers him.
I found it easier to play for him than most conductors. I thought he generated the most extraordinary atmosphere in the concert. The poetic beauty that he produced immediately in the concert hall and also in the Gramophone Studio, he was lost in it all, so much so that we were lost in it all. His extraordinary beat, which has been criticized and laughed at, commented on, caricatured, was, in my experience, absolutely simple to play with. Because, of course, the rhythm and the accents were coming from inside him. The fact that his hands quivered added to the emotion of the performance. His left hand was usually clenched and held down, so that his arm looked straight and almost stiff. Whereas his right hand, holding the baton in perhaps rather an awkward manner, was quivering. But that, we weren't looking at that, really. It wasn't the baton which gave us the rhythm. It didn't matter about the quivering beat. It added excitement to it all. And in fact, grave beauty. I remember when he first came to conduct the Philharmonia Orchestra, I can see him now and hear the music to this day. He seemed to fall back in sort of amazement at the sound he'd conjured from the orchestra. It seemed to affect him. He seemed to lean back very often when he was conducting, as though the music was sort of flowing at him. And he seemed amazed. I mean, he looked as though he were amazed at the gorgeous sound he'd started off. And of course, that has a profound effect upon any player with imagination.
His best-remembered performances of Tristan before the war were with Frieda Leider, who after the war worked with him as producer.
It was in 1947, here in Berlin, at the occasion of the first new production of Tristan at the State Opera after the war. At this time, my career as singer was finished, but I was working with the State Opera as producer. This performance was born under a lucky star, as we were able to do a modern production which had been forbidden for so many years by the Nazis. Furtwängler had the fire, the passion, and the melancholy necessary for Tristan. So everybody worked with such love and joy, and Furtwängler was so inspired that it was a great evening for all artists and audience.
The Tristan recording, which was made in London with Kirsten Flagstad and the Philharmonia, was arranged by Walter Legg.
In my experience, he was not an impressive man, except when he was conducting or making music. I think he was unhappy at the thought, at 7:30 or at 8 o'clock in the evening, that somebody else was conducting somewhere, and he wasn't. I think he was desperately jealous of everybody else. He was not, as many other conductors are, avaricious. I don't think money really meant all that to him, and I don't remember him ever asking exorbitant fees. But all this had nothing to do with his music making. The man and his music were two entirely different phenomena. He was virtually the last of the great conductors to pay the most scrupulous attention to rehearsing. Each performance he would have the singers in, even in the interval, to rehearse an ensemble, in the way that Strauss used to, and the way all the great conductors of the past did, but don't do now. He was absolutely convinced that what he did was right, and he was so convinced of it that anybody who did anything else was ipso facto wrong. I'm quite sure that he made the most sincere attempt throughout his life to identify himself with every work he conducted. But he saw it so strongly through his own eyes that every performance he gave seemed to me a highly personalized one. It was not you're listening to Beethoven, but this is what I believe about Beethoven. But on the other hand, I think the best of Furtwängler is all the way through the Tristan recording. From the first bar to the last, the whole thing seems to be, as far as any man can do it, recreated as it must have happened in the crucible of Wagner's own mind. And at that glowing white heat.
wasn't in his element recording, because he was the kind that couldn't do anything unless it was inspired. He couldn't rehearse in the sense of coldly approaching his task, because he loved the music and was carried away, and people played for him. There was no accounting for energy wasted. Once he was in the music, he made the most of it, and whether it was rehearsal or concert.
Most of the recordings in this program were made during concert performances, but Tristan and his recording of the Schumann Fourth Symphony are two notable exceptions. There's an interesting story about how the Schumann Fourth was done.
It was a little difficult with him by recording, because he didn't like to be disturbed. He could not play more forte or more piano, because record it neat. And we made the Fourth Symphony of Schumann, and it was a little difficult with Wilhelm Furtwängler. And after some time, he said, "You can have this symphony, but without interruption. I will play it from beginning to the finish, but do not disturb and no interruption." And we made it, and I think this is one of the best records from Wilhelm Furtwängler and the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra.
Paul Kletzky recalls Furtwängler's particular preoccupation with Schumann.
The most important for him was the spiritual value of the music, and besides everything, he gave the greatest importance for things behind the written notes. He was always looking for the great build-up for the idea. When there is a going over from one theme to another, was much more important than the flowing of the music all the time.
Thank you. It was at a concert which included a performance of the Schumann Fourth that Raphael Kubelik first heard Furtwängler.
My first impressions, you know, were when I was 14 and when Furtwängler came to Prague, playing Schumann Four and Tchaikovsky Four. And for me, it was an unforgettable evening, and I still somehow hear it, even today. He influenced my whole life by this evening. Since then, I wish to be a conductor. And I must say, his approach to music was of such a nature that a man who had the luck to understand and to be there must have been lifted, must have been innerly reborn, practically. And that is the greatness of a conductor.
His own preoccupation with the spiritual content of the music he conducted, and his fear that this element was being lost in modern music, gained him in later life the reputation for being anti-modern music in general. Berthold Goldschmidt and Hans Keller.
Well, he certainly was not anti-Hindemith, whose works he performed very frequently. And I also remember a very excellent performance of Prokofiev's third piano concerto with a composer as a soloist, and also Bartok playing his piano concerto. But whether Furtwängler really liked the harsh sounds, I don't know. He always tried to mellow the sound, and you got never a crystal clear aggressive outline from the orchestra.
He considered it a matter of conscience to perform contemporary music. Some of it, especially the tonal parts, he performed very well. But he certainly had strong resistances to all music which wasn't tonal, because he believed in the eternity of the triad. I had a big and highly satisfactory row with him. That was at the Albert Hall. In the artist's room, he forgot his lunch. He said that he was strongly impressed with the things I had written, except for my whole attitude towards atonal and 12-tonal music. Well, then highly interesting row developed, interesting from a personal point of view, because although he was in his 60s, he behaved quite admirably, like a 20-year-old. He was fiery, he was passionate, he banged his table and so on. And, of course, he said all the things one would have expected him to say. In short, that 12-tone technique was not really natural, and that harmonic music as he knew it, triadic music, was the only natural possibility for creative expression. Well, I myself didn't quite know what to say, because I didn't see much point in contradicting him, so I got a bit of a headache. He didn't, but nevertheless, I greatly admired him for this performance.
His concern with contemporary music may have been a matter of conscience, but it was a conscience that went deep, and like everything else he did, he made the best of it. Most of his programs between 1922 and 1939 included modern works, and his defense of contemporary music inevitably led him into disastrous conflict with the Nazis.
Actually, the big blow-up came in 1935 over the Hindemith issue. Furtwängler defended Hindemith, and of course the Nazis claimed that this was degenerate art and that this was Jewish infected and God knows what. And he resigned from the Berlin Philharmonic over the battle about Hindemith. And after that, an order went out to all the newspapers that Furtwängler's name was not to be mentioned in any place publicly, and they took away Furtwängler's passport to be sure that he would remain inside of Germany and not become a propaganda star, let us say, against the Nazi regime outside of Germany. And this started this totally ambiguous game and let us say also tragedy around Furtwängler, that inside of Germany they treated him like a pariah, and outside of Germany, of course, they used him for their own purposes and propaganda ends. I think Furtwängler, of course, could have left very easily early in 33 when the borders were still wide open. But I know from Friedrich Schorr that Furtwängler felt it was his duty as a musician to remain in Germany and to try to save culturally what possibly could be saved at a time Germany was headed for her ruin.
They didn't touch us in the orchestra because Furtwängler stood for us. We had no school evenings, as the Nazis always had, in every factory and so on, in every opera house. We not. We didn't say when we came to the rehearsal in the morning, Heil Hitler. We said, Guten Morgen. Not Heil Hitler. Furtwängler said, never Heil Hitler.
My wife, for instance, my wife is Jewish, and I was a member of the orchestra till the end of the war. Without Furtwängler, was impossible.
He did many brave things. I know personally several musicians whom he saved and managed to get out. He never became a member of the party, but he did accept one or two associations. He was a member of the Kulturkammer, which he could have refused. But then we must again see it from his own point of view. He was German and thought he might be of some influence. And when he realized where he was and that he had no ability to do what he wanted, he at least refused to travel with the German orchestras to occupied countries, which is to his credit. And then about a year and a half before the end of the war, he made his escape from Germany. I think he remained a rather vague and pathetic character in the end of his life, because his underpinning was taken away from him. Being German and seeing what had happened to his country, he was torn inside of him with a sense of emptiness.
So his efforts to help his country made Furtwängler yet another victim of the greatest wickedness our century has known. During the time of his disgrace, after the Hindemith issue, Furtwängler returned to what he had always considered to be his true vocation, composing, and completed his piano concerto. He gave the first performance with Edwin Fischer in November 1937, and the work was recently performed by the Berlin Philharmonic and Zubin Mehta with Daniel Barenboim as soloist.
Well, the piece is a sort of naive work, very sincere. Every note of it was written, I think, with deep conviction and sincerity. And it is rather naive. I mean, the influences are strongly felt, mostly those of Bruckner, Brahms, and Wagner, in the orchestration especially. But these things didn't bother me at all, because I think the sincerity of the musician comes across. I feel it has even more right in the repertoire than his symphony, because for the symphonies, we have the symphonies of Bruckner and Mahler, but there is no piano concerto in the repertoire in this line after Brahms. The real post-romantic piano concerto is missing, and it fits in very well. It might be a little too long, of course. It was 68 minutes in Berlin, but if its length is not entirely justified, its existence is more than certainly so.
Furtwängler died of pneumonia on the 30th of November 1954 at the age of 68. During his last illness, he wrote in a letter, "In the evening after the concert, a conductor's work is over. For this reason, conducting is an activity built on sand. Really, to live on in posterity, one completed musical composition is more important than the life's work of a conductor. And for this reason, composing seems to me the more urgent task. Unfortunately, the circumstances of the world seduced me, and I gave too little time to this task. Today, my serious illness has reminded me of this omission." His concern for posterity may be seen as vanity, but to those who knew him, and to those who understand his deep belief in the spiritual value of his art, his motives are not in question. What he wrote of a great composer in this respect may well be said of Furtwängler himself. He succeeded in achieving a mysterious synthesis of subjective individuality and objective realization, a combination of an apparently limited nature with boundless offering of self to higher things and to the good of all.
That program about Wilhelm Furtwängler was compiled and narrated by Christopher Newpen and produced by Christopher Sykes. The BBC wishes to express its gratitude to the contributors and to RIAS Berlin, Radio Salzburg, and the Salzburg Festival Direction for recordings used in the program. Among those contributing were Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, Yehudi Menuhin, Gregor Piatigorsky, Raphael Kubelik, and Simon Goldberg.